This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Chip in Tampa, Florida on April the 4th, 2006. The Return of the Native by Thomas Hardy. Chapter 5. Perplexity Among Honest People. Thomason looked as if quite overcome by her aunt's change of manner.
"It means just what it seems to mean. I am not married," she replied faintly. "Excuse me for humiliating you, aunt, by this mishap. I am sorry for it, but I cannot help it."
"Me? Think of yourself first."
"It was nobody's fault. When we got there, the parson wouldn't marry us because of some trifling irregularity with the license."
"What irregularity?"
"I don't know. Mr. Wildeve can explain. I did not think when I went away this morning that I should come back like this."
It being dark, Thomason allowed her emotion to escape her by the silent way of tears which could roll down her cheek unseen. "I could say almost that it serves you right, if I did not feel that you don't deserve it," continued Mrs. Yeobright, who, possessing two distinct moods in close contiguity, a gentle mood and an angry, flew from one to the other without the least warning. "Remember, Thomason, this business was none of my seeking. From the very first, when you began to feel foolish about that man, I warned you he would not make you happy. I felt it so strongly that I did what I would never have believed myself capable of doing, stood up in the church and made myself the public talk for weeks. But having once consented, I don't submit to these fancies without good reason. Marry him you must after this."
"Do you think I wish to do otherwise for one moment?" said Thomason with a heavy sigh. "I know how wrong it was of me to love him, but don't pain me by talking like that, aunt. You would not have had me stay there with him, would you? And your house is the only home I have to return to. He says we can be married in a day or two."
"I wish he had never seen you."
"Very well, then I will be the miserablest woman in the world and not let him see me again. No, I won't have him."
"It's too late to speak so. Come with me. I am going to the inn to see if he has returned. Of course, I shall get to the bottom of this story at once. Mr. Wildeve must not suppose he can play tricks upon me or any belonging to me."
"It was not like that. The license was wrong, and he couldn't get another the same day. He will tell you in a moment now how it was, if he comes."
"Why didn't he bring you back?"
"That was me," again sobbed Thomason. "When I found we could not be married, I didn't like to come back with him, and I was very ill, and then I saw Diggory Ben, and he was glad to get him and take me home. I cannot explain it any better, and you must be angry with me if you will."
"I shall see about that," said Mrs. Yeobright, and they turned towards the inn, well known in the neighborhood as the Quiet Woman. The sign of her, which represented the figure of a matron carrying her head under her arm, beneath which gruesome design was written the couplet so well known to frequenters of the inn, "Since the woman's quiet, let no man breed a riot." Footnote: the inn which really bore this sign and legend stood some miles to the northwest of the present scene, wherein the house more immediately referred to is now no longer an inn, and the surroundings are much changed. But another inn, some of whose features are also embodied in this description, the Red Lion at Winfrith, still remains as a haven for the wayfarer. 1912. The front of the house was towards the heath and rain barrow, whose dark shape seemed to threaten it from the sky. Upon the door was a neglected brass plate bearing the unexpected inscription, "Mr. Wildeve, Engineer," a useless yet cherished relic from the time when he had been started in that profession in an office at Budmouth by those who had hoped much from him and had been disappointed. The garden was at the back, and behind this ran a still deep stream, forming the margin of the heath in that direction, meadowland appearing beyond the stream. But the thick obscurity permitted only skylines to be visible of any scene at present. The water at the back of the house could be heard idly spinning whirlpools in its creep between the rows of dry feather-headed reeds which formed a stockade along each bank. Their presence was denoted by sounds as of a congregation praying humbly, produced by their rubbing against each other in the slow wind. The window whence the candlelight had shone up the veil to the eyes of the bonfire group was uncurtained, but the sill lay too high for a pedestrian on the outside to look over it into the room. A vast shadow, in which could be dimly traced portions of a masculine contour, blotted half the ceiling. "He seems to be at home," said Mrs. Yeobright.
"Must I come in too, aunt?" asked Thomason faintly. "I suppose not. It would be wrong."
"You must come, certainly, to confront him, so that he may make no false representations to me. We shall not be 5 minutes in the house, and then we'll walk home." Entering the open passage, she tapped at the door of the private parlor, unfastened it, and looked in. The back and shoulders of a man came between Mrs. Yeobright's eyes and the fire. Wildeve, whose form it was, immediately turned, arose, and advanced to meet his visitors. He was quite a young man, and of the two properties, form and motion, the latter first attracted the eye to him. The grace of his movement was singular. It was the pantomimic expression of a lady-killing career. Next came to notice the more material qualities, among which was a profuse crop of hair impending over the top of his face, lending to his forehead the high-cornered outline of an early Gothic shield, and a neck which was smooth and round as a cylinder. The lower half of his figure was of light build. Altogether, he was one in whom no man would have seen anything to admire, and in whom no woman would have seen anything to dislike. He discerned the young girl's form in the passage, and said, "Thomason, then, has reached home. How could you leave me that way, darling?" And turning to Mrs. Yeobright, it was useless to argue with her. She would go, and go alone. "But what's the meaning of it all?" demanded Mrs. Yeobright haughtily. "Take a seat," said Wildeve, placing chairs for the two women. "Well, it was a very stupid mistake, but such mistakes will happen. The license was useless at Anglebury. It was made out for Budmouth, but as I didn't read it, I wasn't aware of that."
"But you had been staying at Anglebury."
"No, I had been at Budmouth until 2 days ago, and that was where I had intended to take her, but when I came to fetch her, we decided upon Anglebury, forgetting that a new license would be necessary. There was not time to get to Budmouth afterwards."
"I think you are very much to blame," said Mrs. Yeobright. "It was quite my fault we chose Anglebury," Thomason pleaded. "I proposed it because I was not known there."
"I know so well that I am to blame that you need not remind me of it," replied Wildeve shortly.
"Such things don't happen for nothing," said the aunt. "It is a great slight to me and my family, and when it gets known there will be a very unpleasant time for me. How can she look her friends in the face tomorrow? It is a very great injury, and one I cannot easily forgive. It may even reflect on her character."
"Nonsense," said Wildeve. Thomason's large eyes had flown from the face of one to the face of the other during this discussion, and she now said anxiously,
"Will you allow me, aunt, to talk it over alone with Damon for 5 minutes? Will you, Damon?"
"Certainly, dear," said Wildeve, "if your aunt will excuse us." He led her into an adjoining room, leaving Mrs. Yeobright by the fire. As soon as they were alone and the door closed, Thomason said, turning up her pale, tearful face to him,
"It is killing me, this, Damon. I did not mean to part from you in anger at Anglebury this morning, but I was so frightened, and I hardly knew what I said. I have not let Aunt know how much I suffered today. It is so hard to command my face and voice, and to smile as if it were a slight thing to me. But I try to do so, that she might not be still more indignant with you. I know you could not help it, dear, whatever my aunt might think."
"She is very unpleasant."
"Yes," Thomason murmured, "and I suppose I seem so now. Damon, what do you mean to do about me?"
"Do about you?"
"Yes. Those who don't like you whisper such things which at moments make me doubt you. We mean to marry, I suppose, don't we?"
"Of course we do. We have only to go to Budmouth on Monday, and we marry at once."
"Then do let us go. Oh, Damon, what you make me say."
She hid her face in her handkerchief.
"Here I am asking you to marry me, when by rights you ought to be on your knees imploring me, your cruel mistress, not to refuse you, and saying it would break your heart if I did. I used to think it would be pretty and sweet like that, but how different."
"Yes, real life is never at all like that."
"But I don't care personally if it never takes place," she added with a little dignity. "No, I can live without you. It is Aunt I think of. She is so proud, and thinks so much of her family respectability, that she will be cut down with mortification if this story should get abroad before it is done. My cousin Clem, too, will be much wounded."
"Then he will be very unreasonable. In fact, you're all rather unreasonable." Thomason coloured a little, and not with love. But whatever the momentary feeling which caused that flush in her, it went as it came, and she humbly said,
"I never mean to be, if I can help it. I merely feel that you have my aunt to some extent in your power at last."
"As a matter of justice, it is almost due to me," said Wildeep. "Think what I have gone through to win her consent, the insult that it is to any man to have the banns forbidden, the double insult to a man unlucky enough to be cursed with sensitiveness and blue demons and heaven knows what, as I am. I can never forget those banns. A harsher man would rejoice now in the power I have of turning upon your aunt by going no further in the business." She looked wistfully at him with her sorrowful eyes as he said those words, and her aspect showed that more than one person in the room could deplore the possession of sensitiveness. Seeing that she was really suffering, he seemed disturbed, and added, "This is merely a reflection, you know. I have not the least intention to refuse to complete the marriage. Tamsiman, I could not bear it."
"You could not, I know," said the fair girl, brightening. "You who cannot bear the sight of pain in even an insect, or in any disagreeable sound, or unpleasant smell even, will not long cause pain to me and mine."
"I will not, if I can help it."
"Your hand upon it, Damon."
He carelessly gave her his hand. "Ah, by my crown, what's that?" he said suddenly. There fell upon their ears the sound of numerous voices singing in front of the house. Among these, two made themselves prominent by their peculiarity. One was a very strong bass, the other a wheezy, thin piping. Thomason recognized them as belonging to Timothy Fareway and Grandfrere Cantle, respectively.
"What does it mean? It is not skimmity riding, I hope," she said, with a frightened gaze at Wildeve.
"Of course not. No, it is that the heath folk have come to sing us a welcome." "This is intolerable," he began pacing about, the men outside singing cheerfully. "He told her she was the joy of his life, and if she'd consent he would make her his wife. She could not refuse him to church, so they went. Young Will was forgot, and young Sue was content. And then she was kissed and set down on his knee. No man in the world was so loving as he. Mrs. Yeobright burst in from the outer room. "Thomason! Thomason!" she said, looking indignantly at Wildeve. "Here's a pretty exposure! Let us escape at once! Come!" It was, however, too late to get away by the passage. A rugged knocking had begun upon the door of the front room. Wildeve, who had gone to the window, came back. "Stop!" he said imperiously, putting his hand upon Mrs. Yeobright's arm. "We are regularly besieged. There are 50 of them out there if there's one. You stay in this room with Thomas, and I'll go out and face them. You must stay now for my sake till they are gone, so that it may seem as if all was right. Come, Tamsie, dear, don't go making a scene. We must marry after this. That you can see as well as I. Sit still, that's all. And don't speak much. I'll manage them, plundering fools." He pressed the agitated girl into a seat, returned to the outer room, and opened the door. Immediately outside, in the passage, appeared Grandfrère Cantle, singing in concert with those still standing in front of the house. He came to the room, nodded abstractedly to Wildeve, his lips still parted, and his features excruciatingly strained in the admission of the chorus. This being ended, he said heartily, "Here's welcome to the new-made couple, and God bless 'em!" "Thank you," said Wildeve, with dry resentment, his face as gloomy as a thunderstorm. At the Grandfrère's heels now came the rest of the group, which included Fairway, Christian, Sam the Turf-cutter, Humphrey, and a dozen others. All smiled upon Wildeve, and upon his tables and chairs likewise, from a general sense of friendliness towards the articles, as well as towards their owner. "We be not here afore Mrs. Yeobright after all," said Fairway, recognizing the matron's bonnet through the glass partition which divided the public apartment they had entered from the room where the women sat. "We struck down across, you see, Mr. Wildeve, and she went round by the path." "And I see the young bride's little head," said Grandfrère, peeping in the same direction and discerning Thomason, who was waiting beside her aunt in a miserable and awkward way. "Not quite settled yet. Well, there's plenty of time." Wildeve made no reply, and probably feeling that the sooner he treated them, the sooner they would go, he produced a stone jar, which threw a warm halo over matters at once. "There's a drop of the right sort, I can see," said Grandfrère Cantle, with the air of a man too well-mannered to show any hurry to taste it. "Yes," said Wildeve, "'tis some old mead. I hope you will like it." "Oh, aye!" replied the guests, in the hearty tones natural when the words demanded by politeness coincide with those of deepest feeling. "There isn't a prettier drink under the sun." "I'll take my oath there isn't," added Grandfrère Cantle. "All that can be said against mead is that 'tis rather heady and apt to lie about a man a good while, but to-morrow's Sunday, thank God. I feel all the world like some bold soldier after I had had some once," said Christian. "You shall feel so again," said Wildeve with condescension. "Cups or glasses, gentlemen?" "Well, if you don't mind, we'll have the beaker and pass it around. 'Tis better than kneeling it out in dribbles." "Down the slippery glasses," said Grandfrère Cantle. "What's the good of a thing you can't put down in the ashes to warm, eh, neighbors? That's what I ask." "Right, Grandfrère," said Sam, and the mead then circulated. "Well," said Timothy Fairway, feeling demands upon his praise in some form or other, "'tis a worthy thing to be married, Mr. Wildeve, and the woman you got is a dismount, so says I. Yes," he continued to Grandfrère Cantle, raising his voice so as to be heard through the partition, "her father," inclining his head towards the inner room, "was as good a feller as ever lived. He always had this great indignation ready against anything underhand."
"Is that very dangerous?" said Christian.
"And there were few in these parts who were upsides with him," said Sam.
Whenever a club walked, he'd play the clarinet in the band that marched before him, as if he'd never touched anything but a clarinet all his life. And then, when they got to church door, he'd throw down the clarinet, mount the gallery, and snatch up the bass viol, and roz him away as if he'd never played anything but the bass viol. Folk would say, folk that knowed what a true stave was, "Surely, surely that's never the same man that I saw handling the clarinet so masterly by now." "I can mind it," said the furze cutter. 'Twas a wonderful thing that one body could hold it all and never mix the fingering." "There was Kingsbere Church likewise," Fareway recommenced, as one opening a new vein at the same mine of interest. Wildeve breathed the breath of one intolerably bored, and glanced through the partition at the prisoners.
"He used to walk over there of a Sunday morning to visit his old acquaintance Andrew Brown, the first clarinet there. A good man enough, but rather screechy in his music, if you can mind."
"I was."
"And neighbour Yobright would take Andre's place for some part of the service, to let Andre have a bit of a nap, as any friend would naturally do."
"As any friend would," said Grandfrère Cantle,
the other listeners expressing the same accord by the shorter way of nodding their heads.
"No sooner was Andre asleep than the first whiff of neighbour Yobright's wind had got up inside Andre's clarinet than everyone in the church field in a moment that there was a great soul among 'em. All heads would turn, and they'd say, 'Ah, I thought 'twas he.' One Sunday, I can well mind, a bass viol day at that time, and Yobright had brought his own. 'Twas the 133rd to Lydia, and when they'd come to ran down his beard and o'er his robes its costly moisture shed, neighbour Yobright, who had just warmed to his work, drove his bow into them strings, that glorious grand, that e'en almost sawed the bass viol into two pieces. Every winder in the church rattled, as if there were a thunderstorm. Old Parson Williams lifted his hands in his great holy surplice, as natural as if he'd been in common clothes, and seemed to say to himself, 'Oh, for such a man in our parish!' But not a soul in Kingsbere could hold a candle to Yobright."
"Was it quite safe when the winder shook?" Christian inquired.
He received no answer, all for the moment sitting rapt in admiration of the performances described. As with Farinelli's singing before the princesses, Sheridan's renowned Begum speech, and other such examples, the fortunate condition of its being forever lost to the world invested the deceased Mr. Yobright's tour de force on that memorable afternoon with a cumulative glory which comparative criticism, had that been possible, might considerably have shorn down.
"He was the last you'd expect to drop off in the prime of life," said Humphrey.
"Ah, well, he was looking for the earth some months afore he went. At that time women used to run for smocks and gown pieces at Greenhill Fair, and my wife that is there now, being a long-legged slittering maid, hardly husband high, went with the rest of the maidens, for I was a good runner afore she got so heavy. When she came home, I said, we were then just beginning to walk together, 'What have you got, me honey?'
'I've won, well, I've won a gown piece,' says she, her colours coming up in a moment. 'Tis a smock for a crown,' I thought, and so it turned out. Aye, when I think what she'll say to me now, without a muscle of red in her face, it do seem strange that I wouldn't say much a little thing then. However, then she went on, and that's what made me bring up the story. Well, whatever clothes I've worn, white or figured, for eyes to see or for eyes not to see, I could do a pretty stroke of modesty in those days, I'd sooner have lost it than have seen what I have. Poor Mr. Yobright was took bad directly he reached the fairground, and was forced to go home again, and that was the last time he ever went out to the parish. I faltered on one day to another, and then we heard he was gone."
"Do you think he was in great pain when he died?" said Christian.
"Oh, no, quite different. Nor any pain of mind. He was lucky enough to be God A'mighty's own man."
"And the other folk, do you think 'twill be much pain to 'em, Mr. Fareway?"
"That depends on whether they be afeared."
"I bain't afeared at all, I thank God," said Christian strenuously. "I'm glad I bain't, for there 'twon't pain me. And I don't think I be afeared, or if I be, I can't help it, and then I don't deserve to suffer. I wish I was not afeared at all."
There was a solemn silence, and looking from the window, which was unshuttered and unblinded, Timothy said,
"Well, what a fast little bonfire that one is out by Captain Vyse. 'Tis burning just the same now as there, upon my life."
All glances went to the window, and nobody noticed that Wildeeb disguised a brief telltale look. Far away up the sombre valley of the heath, and to the right of Rainbarrow, could indeed be seen the light, small but steady, and persistent as before.
"It was lighted before ours was," Fareway continued, "and yet every one in the county round is out before un."
"Perhaps there's meaning in it?" murmured Christian.
"How meaning?" said Wildeeb sharply.
Christian was too scattered to reply, and Timothy helped him.
"You mean, sir, that the lonesome dark-eyed creature up there, that some say is a witch, ever I should call a fine young woman such a name, is always up to some odd conceit or other, and so perhaps 'tis she. I'd be very glad to take her in wedlock if she'd aim me, and take the risk of her wild dark eyes ill-wishing me," said Grandfrere Cantle staunchly.
"Don't ye say it, father," implored Christian.
"Well, be dazed if you do marry the maid won't have an uncommon picture for his best parlour," said Fareway in a liquid tone, placing down the cup of mead at the end of a good pull. "And a partner as deep as the North Star," said Sam, taking up the cup and finishing the little that remained.
"Well, really, now I think we must be moving," said Humphrey, observing the emptiness of the vessel.
"But we'll gi' him another song," said Grandfrere Cantle. "I'm as full of notes as a bird."
"Thank you, Grandfrere," said Wildeeb, "but we'll not trouble you now. Some other day must do for that, when I can have a party.
Be jound if I don't learn 10 new songs for it, or I won't learn a line," said Grandfrere Cantle. "And may you make sure I won't disappoint ye by biding away, Mr. Wildeeb."
"I quite believe you," said that gentleman. All then took their leave, wishing their entertainer long life and happiness as a married man, with recapitulations which occupied some time. Wildeeb attended them to the door, beyond which the deep-eyed upward stretch of heath stood awaiting them, an amplitude of darkness reigning from their feet almost to the zenith. There was a definite form first became visible in the lowering forehead of Rainbarrow, diving into the dense obscurity in a line headed by Sam the turf-cutter. They pursued their trackless way home. When the scratching of the furs against their leggings had fainted upon the ear, Wildeeb returned to the room where he had left Thomason and her aunt. The women were gone. They could only have left the house in one way, by the back window, and this was open. Wildeeb laughed to himself, remained a moment thinking, and idly returned to the front room. Here his glance fell upon a bottle of wine which stood on the mantelpiece.
"Ah, old Dowden," he murmured, and going to the kitchen door shouted, "Is anybody here who can take something to old Dowden?"
There was no reply. The room was empty, the lad who acted as his factotum having gone to bed. Wildeeb came back, put on his hat, and took the bottle and left the house, turning the key in the door, for there was no guest at the inn to-night. As soon as he was on the road, the little bonfire on Mistover Knap again met his eye.
"Still waiting, are you, m'lady?" he murmured.
However, he did not proceed that way just then, but leaving the hill to the left of him, he stumbled over a rutted road that brought him to a cottage which, like all other habitations on the heath at this hour, was only saved from being visible by a faint shine from its bedroom window. The house was the home of Ollie Dowden, the besom maker, and he entered. The lower room was in darkness, but by feeling his way he found a table, whereupon he placed the bottle, and a minute later emerged again upon the heath. He stood and looked northeast at the undying little fire, high up above him, though not so high as Rainbarrow. We have always been told what happens when a woman deliberates, and the epigram is not always terminable with the woman, provided that one be in the case, and that a fair one. Wildeve stood, and stood longer, and breathed perplexedly, and then said to himself with resignation, "Yes, by heaven, I must go to her, I suppose." Instead of turning in the direction of home, he pressed on rapidly by a path under Rainbarrow towards what was evidently a signal light. So ends Chapter 5, Perplexity Among Honest People.